Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For millions of Americans, the 9-to-5 work life is so over. The gray-suited company men in 50s sitcoms seem practically prehistoric now, kicking back after work with a cocktail and slippers. Their rat race could look pretty good to modern workers stuck texting away during dinner and checking email in bed. Yes, we're supposed to be grateful to have any job suddenly, but still, how did it come to this, the 24/7, always-on-call work life? Can we blame technology? Or did we choose this for ourselves? This hour, On Point, what American work and life have become. You can join the conversation. Are you always on call, never really free from work? These days, are you glad to have it anyway, or worried something is wrong? Joining me now from New York is Dalton Conley, chair of the sociology department at NYU. His new book is Elsewhere, USA, How We Got from the Company Man, Family Dinners, and the Affluent Society to the Home Office, BlackBerry Moms, and Economic Anxiety. Dalton Conley, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me again, Tom.
What has happened here?
Well, as you said in your intro, I think it's very easy to just blame new technology, the internet, Wi-Fi, the cell phone and BlackBerry culture. But really, that's only part of the story, I think. You know, there are plenty of other cultures, for example, Western Europe, have the same access to technology, or if not better, and they maintain divisions better than we do. I think there's some more fundamental economic and social shifts that have occurred over the last 30 or 40 years.
You know, Dalton, I was struck over the weekend. I saw that 9 to 5, the movie that Dolly Parton starred in years ago now, is coming back. It's coming to Broadway, 9 to 5, the musical with songs by Dolly Parton. Of course, when it came out, and I guess that was, I don't know, the early 80s, it was supposed to be a funny but acute commentary on the pain in the neck of working 9 to 5. Now it comes back to Broadway, and it seems like really something antique, something out of the, you know, grandma's attic, the notion of 9 to 5 that somebody pulled down to look at and talk about. What has happened to American work life in that time?
Well, I think that there are, in addition to the technology that you mentioned, there are a couple major trends that have occurred. And the first is the wholesale entry of women, in particular mothers, into the workforce, so that now most households, particularly professional households, have not one but two earners and need to outsource a lot of their formerly, you know, home work or housework or childcare to the marketplace. And of course, the marketplace costs money, which in turn generates the need to work more and becomes a forward-feeding cycle. I'm not suggesting that we should turn back the clock to the days of Ward and June Cleaver, but we have to look beyond just the BlackBerries and think about these larger trends. And the second one is rising inequality. Every year since the 1960s, economic inequality has risen in the United States. Through Carter, through Reagan, through Clinton, through good times and bad times. And we like to think of that, or traditionally we've thought of the inequality rise as being the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer. Mm-hmm. But what's really happened is the bottom half has stayed the same, has been flat. If you look at the person at the 50th percentile, smack in the middle of the middle class in the United States, and compare that person or that household to people at the poverty line, say, or the bottom tenth, the gap has not grown. Where the gap has really grown is in the top half. It just gets wider and wider the further you go up, and it's been almost accelerating in speed. And that's where these increased work hours and use of technology has been occurring among that top half of the income distribution among professionals.
So you describe the situation where, ironically, in a way, it's once people get a toehold on affluence that the pressure's really set on to keep up with the Joneses that are way on up that income ladder, and all the crazy hours and nonstop wired to the BlackBerry kick in. I wish you'd share some of the texture of this. You opened the book with some wonderful examples, sort of looking at, I don't know, the 50s, 60s, and then the 70s, 80s, and then now in terms of the texture of
home life, private life, that emerges with this evolution of our relationship to work?
I could start with my own intergenerational history of my family.
Great.
Which I talk about in the preface. My maternal grandparents lived in a small coal mining town in Pennsylvania. He was the town dentist. She was educated but did not work. Their goal was to work hard so that they could retire early somewhere sunny. And they had weekends off and evenings off with their friends where they would play golf and they didn't really drink much but have cocktails with friends and so on and so forth, very much like the stereotype of the 1950s.
And aiming indeed, to retire at what sort of age, Dalton, in your grandparents'
case? In his 50s.
Okay.
And he successfully did that. His children, by contrast, found work as more of an emotional or an identity calling, that work wasn't something that you did to ensure the material security of your family and your children and then got over it and lived the good life, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Work was art for my father.
This is your parents' generation.
Yeah, writing for my mother. And it's something that you did because you loved it, but you still turned off the electric typewriter or
right.
The air compressor or whatever it is
at some point in
dinner
the day.
Time,
right.
Right, and cooked dinner at home. And we had us kids had a lot of freedom after school. We would run around a much more dangerous New York City than it is now. I can't believe that we were given such freedom back in the 1970s. And as long as we were home for dinner, and then we had family time and went to bed.
But there was a dinner and a dinner time and a family evening time and a bedtime. All that existed.
And there was real leisure. My parents would have friends over, and they would entertain them. And it wasn't about networking, Web 2.0,
right.
or getting ahead. It was literally leisure, which was something that people used to think was created by modern capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
That we had a division between the private sphere, the household, and the public sphere, the marketplace. And until we had that division out of modern industrial capitalism, we really never had pure social relationships. Back in feudalism, for example,
mm-hmm.
you did business with the same people that you married your daughter off to and the same people that you hung out with on a regular basis in a small village or even in a city, but it was highly sort of – your relationships were at cross purpose. Now we had this new norm. You don't mix business with pleasure. You have two separate spheres, and you'll learn the hard way.
This was your grandparents and your parents, but you're
right.
saying in a way we've turned back the hands of time.
Exactly. In a weird way, we've gone back to pre-capitalism. We're all like craftsmen now doing our trade, except for the old craftsman of yesteryear was limited by the amount of raw materials he or she had. Light. You needed light to do work, to build a chair or to tend to your garden or what
mm-hmm.
have you. Today, with electric lighting and wireless laptops and cell phones and et cetera, we can literally work 24/7, especially given the weightless nature of our economy, that we don't have to produce anything physical.
And many, many do slaves to work right in their own homes even. We've got a lot of people who want to speak to this. Let's go to Salt Lake City, Utah, and Dan in Salt Lake City. Dan, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you. What do you know, Dan?
Well, I work for a small book publisher, it's a very small company. I'm the only employee, and I work from home. And I deal with this challenge every day. Probably the most difficult part about my job is personal time management, keeping everything in order and keeping motivated.
Do you know when you're working and when you're not, Dan, or are you always sort of at work?
I'm always doing both. And I'll work till 7 o'clock at night and then to go do something in the evening and come back maybe and work again until I go to bed. And the nice thing about the job is that there's flexibility and there's freedom, but I find the biggest challenge is keeping a lid on that and keeping everything in order and staying productive. And And when you're working at home, it can be really challenging, as NPR isn't my only distraction during the day.
So. Right. I'm sure we have. There's always the refrigerator. Dan in Salt Lake, thanks very much for calling. Dalton Conley, there it is in a nutshell. He's always doing both, says Dan.
Right. I mean, the very distinction between home and office or work and leisure, I argue, has fallen by the wayside. In as recently as 1979 was the first time that the term home office came into public use in the media. If you searched on home office before 1979, it was referring to that bureaucracy back in London.
Right, or in Chicago or wherever the home office was. Right.
We're not even we're beyond the home office. We have the portable workshop in our palm, literally, and can work walking down the street. And it's not just that we're working all the time; it's that the very texture of our leisure is actually different as well. This sort of ethic that social connections is what gets you ahead, and I'm not disputing that. In a weightless knowledge economy, it may very well be social connections and who controls flows of information that does get you ahead. But when that becomes the ethic, then much of our socializing takes on an instrumental nature, that we're meeting people because, well, maybe there's the person who we're going to team up with to produce the next movie, or they have the next big idea for a product that you want to invest in, or what have you.
And the BlackBerry always in hand if you use one, or the email always blinking to come hither. Dalton Conley in New York City, please stand by. The new book is Elsewhere USA. It's about the work that never ends, America's 24/7 on-call, always distracted work culture bleeding into every other part of life. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour with Dalton Conley. He's author of the new book, Elsewhere USA, How We Got from the Company Man, Family Dinners, and the Affluent Society to the Home Office, BlackBerry Moms, and Economic Anxiety. He joins us from New York. There's a lot we're going to dig into here with Dalton Conley. Let's get another call from Salt Lake City. What a wired place. Tyler, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
Love the show.
Thank you. What do you know?
You know, I'm one of these guys who is connected through, you know, Skype and iChat and the cell phone, all of that. Just an example, on Christmas Eve, I was up in Pocatello with relatives, so that's kind of the blessing part of it. But the curse was I was had to roll out of bed at 7 a.m. and take a phone call. So
in Pocatello for Christmas, and still the cell phone is ringing.
That's right.
How do you deal with it, Tyler?
You know, typically, I think it plays more to my advantage just because I'm able to turn off the cell phone and disconnect when I, you know, need to be with my wife and family. But I've got a kid on the way, so I'm not sure how that's going to change the equation.
But 7 a.m. on Christmas Day? I mean, are you kidding me? How can that be right? Did you hang up on whoever it was? Did you say, don't call me now? Or is work just that? Does work really trump everything?
The way I see it is either 7 a.m. on Christmas Day with friends and family, or it was, you know, 9 a.m. on Christmas Eve back at home where I wasn't with friends and family. So kind of a benefit and also kind of a disadvantage. But I think the benefits outweigh the disadvantages.
And you've got to have the job. Tyler, we appreciate the perspective. That's a great story. 7 a.m., Christmas Day in Pocatello, and the work phone is ringing. Let me get another here from Spencer in Woburn, Massachusetts. Spencer, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This is my first time ever calling NPR about anything that's just too important of an issue.
Let's hear it.
Well, I work in the IT field. I do help desk for a construction company that works nationwide. And I always have BlackBerry, I always have my iPhone, my laptop running. But even I have to walk away at some point at the end of the day because I've got a 3-year-old who begs for my attention when I get home.
How do you do it, Spencer? How do you make the space when you're wired 6 ways to Sunday and you've got the 3-year-old? How do you put the spanner in there?
Well, usually just 8 o'clock, I put down whatever I'm working with and just go, I'll deal with it in the morning. I walk away. My manager, my manager boss, he's always going. He's usually at the office from 9 o'clock in the morning until 9 o'clock at night. One of my friends, who's also an IT manager, works quite long hours. And that's kind of the nature of the beast when it comes to this field, that there's always something to be done. But I just force myself to walk away from it. Have a life.
And do you fear that will crimp your career, Spencer, that commitment to walk away from it? And we salute that. But do you have a secret fear that, what am I walking away from here?
No, I don't think that that's really a necessarily bad thing, because I honestly think that you have to walk away from work at some point. You need to realize that there are more important things. You know, being with your family, being with, you know, your three-year-old son who wants to just sit and play cards with you is, frankly, more important than work.
Spencer, bravo to you, and I hope you can keep it up. Dalton Connolly, you're listening there to our caller from Salt Lake City and from in our backyard here, Woburn, Massachusetts, construction work, where that phone would ring just as long as he would leave it on. Spencer turns it off at a certain point. Who turns it off these days and who doesn't, Dalton? Who's able to say enough and who's not?
He's got more willpower than I have, I have to say. I think that it varies by family type, of course. Now, he's got a three-year-old, he said, and mm-hmm. a three-year-old really, you know, needs you to be on the floor with them and playing with the blocks or the make-believe or whatever.
Yes, they do.
He can just wait for a few more years, even by 5 or 6, and that kid will be grabbing his laptop and trying to Bogart it and get on to Webkinz or Club Penguin or whatever the popular site is in a couple of years, where kids are being socialized to do exactly what we do, which is do knowledge games to outsource the needs of their puffle pets or their Webkinz avatars and into the marketplace where they earn coins and then go buy food for their pets rather than cooking it at home. And, you know, each economy produces the kids it needs. So now our computer games and the increase in homework to stress out even kids in kindergarten is all to prepare them for the kind of life that we live as adults or they're going to live when they get older. So this ability to set boundaries and have commitment mechanisms like turning off your cell phone or, you know, leaving it home on a vacation, for example, are going to be increasingly a fault line along which we're going to be divided. And I'm not here to judge which way is better or worse. I do think that in bad times like now with the economy in recession, people are going to feel the pressure to work harder because they want to hold on to what they have. And in good times, they're going to feel the pressure to work harder because other people are going to be getting ahead even more than them when they look up the income ladder and see them kind of pulling away like the galaxies, the redshift in the galaxies.
Ever expanding, so, if they take their eye off the ball. I want to get a call right here from Miami, Florida, if I may, Dalton. Karen in Miami, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. First off, I'd like to thank the author for writing a book. I think it's a wonderful thing for us to be examining as Americans. The means by which we attain affluence in our current society, I think, is what we need to take a look at in our work life. You mentioned that it's an ethic to have social connections that perhaps get us ahead, and I may argue that that would be actually a vice, that the ethic would be to cultivate relationships that we would normally want to cultivate. The dinner rule, you know, doing business with people that we would love to have dinner with. I think it's an important part of being human. But to also realize that the relationships with our spouses and our children are equally fulfilling and can lead us to success and happiness as workers.
Karen, I love your perspective. Let me ask, are you able to hold that line in your own personal and work life?
I'm doing the very best I can, but I do believe that we're all trying to create a new balance for ourselves, and the women especially. We have to redefine feminism, combining, of course, the love of our children, the love of our husbands, and the love of our work.
And what do you say to Dalton Connolly's observation? He is tracing the taproot of this back in part to so many mothers going into the workforce. How do you think about that, Karen?
Well, we're educated, we're intelligent, and we're passionate about our craft. So I fully encourage women to work, and like I said, we are all trying to strike a balance, and I encourage men as well to strike the balance, to discover the value of our home lives and the people that we love and want to be with.
Mm. Amen to that. Karen in Miami, thanks very much for calling. Dalton, she really gets right to the heart of it with her phrase that they're saying, you know, we need to look at the means by which we obtain affluence. It's really what you're all about here. And you describe a kind of splitting of the American personality, American individuals. You call them intravisuals because they've got so many tracks going on at one time. Is that okay? Is that just the nature of the beast, as Spencer said, or is it bad?
I mean, I'm not here to cast moral judgments. It's really descriptive, and I think that's just the way it is for many of us. Now, I would like to comment on the rise in maternal labor force participation. If you go back to the 1950s that many of us think is some sort of prehistory or halcyon days, you know, on the right, they think, families were strong, fertility was high, and, mom stayed at home. And on the left, they think, wow, inequality was at its lowest, ever in the United States, and taxes were the most progressive they ever were, and we were all doing well.
Sounds like everybody loves the past in that telling.
Right. It is true that the maternal labor force participation was at 17% in the mid-1950s. And even by 1975, at the height of the ERA movement, it was only a third, 33%. And today it's around 70%. So the norm is completely shifted. Now a stay-at-home mom is in the minority and working moms are in the majority. Now, I'm not advocating turning back the clock, as I said earlier, but the missing part of this is the work-life balance for dad. So if moms are going to work more, perhaps dad should work less, but it hasn't worked out that way, partly because of culture and partly because of public policy. For example, in the Netherlands and Scandinavian countries, both parents get paid family leave. And in fact, in some Scandinavian countries, the dad can't transfer it to the mom. So it's kind of use it or lose it for mm-hmm. the dad as well as the mom. And while my generation of American fathers has increased the amount of child care that we do and the amount of housework we do, we're still lagging far, far behind women who have really two shifts to work and are more stressed out than we are if we're honest with ourselves.
Karen in Miami, thanks for your call. Dalton, we've got an email here from Michelle. She says, part of the problem, I believe, is that work has taken the place of religion in many of our lives. We define ourselves through our work. We prove that we are good, serious, smart, and worthwhile people through our work. Work orients us and locates us in the social world to a degree that it seems it never did historically. Work has become our living rather than something we do to make a living. What do you say, Professor?
I agree with that, but I don't think that's necessarily something new in the United States, nor something completely divorced from religion, actually. If we go back to the 19th century in America, a keen social observer, the sociologist Max Weber from Germany, mm-hmm. came and said that in America, the Protestant ethic was the most evident or highly developed. And he argued that the Protestant ethic drove capitalism itself in that unlike in the Catholic Church, when you could take communion and go through the rites of confession and et cetera, the major rites to assure that you would be saved and go to heaven, in the Protestant Church, you were kind of alone with God and had to prove to yourself and to your maker that you were among the chosen and blessed. And the way you did that was showing that you were blessed on earth in the form of material wealth. And that led to a culture of entrepreneurship and asceticism. You didn't spend your money on the newest iPhone. You saved it and you became a bit miserly. And you had to also find an occupation, a calling, a vocation, which literally means calling. And if you could do those things, then you were blessed and you were saved in the Calvinist and Protestant tradition more generally.
Fair enough. But as you describe it, I mean, there was at least a self to walk away from work at some point. Now, walk away from work and who are you?
Right. Something else that 19th century social observers were very keen then and are useful today, because another German, Georg Simmel, argued that the self came out of the unique combination of your group affiliations. So Tom, you're an NPR host. I don't know what your family situation is, but you have that's a group you belong to, and your PTA, your bowling league. What, you know, you can go down the list of the groups of people who you interact with, and probably you're the only person who fits that unique intersection of all those groups, Zimmel pointed out, and that's what makes you an individual. And this notion of an authentic self that you come out into the world to present, that's created ironically by your group membership. But today, the groups are endless and borderless. If you go onto Facebook, not only do you see the people who are your friends, you can go onto many of their pages if they're accessible and see who their friends are and friend more and more people into a giant contentless group that has no distinctions between in-group and out-group and therefore has no kind of self or identity or individual conferring ability.
But I thought you were saying I would only bother to socialize with people if there were something in it for me, if I were one of these sort of modern people that you're describing, that it was always a dinner to network and so on. I have to tell you, I am not into that. But but I mean, is it a real social life if it were always to be what's in it for me when you're socializing?
I mean, it's still a social life, but – and of course, this is a matter of degrees I'm talking about. It's not, a black or white dichotomy. But for many of us, particularly those who are working all the time and feel the need to get ahead, social life becomes an avenue to more social life and to new opportunities and invitations and connections that might help us get ahead. And to a certain extent, that's always been the case. It's been the case for the 1950s, romanticized family of the company man, the organization man, and William H. White's rendition, but who had to display loyalty to a certain company and socialize only within that company and among the other spouses that belong to that company, the other families. Today, with a flattened economy and the new knowledge economy, really potentially anybody, the other dad in the sandbox next to you might be your next client. So it has corrupted, if to use a fairly judgmental word, the idea of just pure socialization for friendship's sake.
Let's get a quick call from Sue in Stoughton, Massachusetts. Sue, we've only got half a minute to the break. What's your observation?
Yes, hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
This is very interesting, and I was almost expecting my first thought to be mentioned right away. I have observed that for many years now that so many people have been laid off, and it seems like everyone else that I'm aware of who are fortunate enough to have their jobs are doing double time because of all the layoffs.
Right.
And I was almost expecting that to be kind of the number one reason, and I'm surprised to hear all these other reasons mentioned first.
But the layoffs have a big role to play themselves. Sue, we're coming up on a break here, but I promise when we come back, we'll look at exactly that, the economic pressure that's there, and especially there in this last few months or a year. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. My guest this hour is Dalton Conley. He's author of the new book, Elsewhere USA, How We Got from the Company Man, Family Dinners, and the Affluent Society to the Home Office, BlackBerry Moms, and Economic Anxiety. He joins us from New York. BlackBerry president as well, we're told, though they may take Obama's away. Dalton Conley, just before the break, Sue said, hey, wait a minute. What about layoffs? People are working because maybe they've got fewer colleagues to share the work with, or maybe they're more worried about their own job. You wrote, when we look at the economy as a whole, we find that volatility has greatly decreased over the last 25 years. Well, yes, until, oops, now we're in a major, major slump on employment. How does that affect the thesis?
I think that, as I mentioned earlier, the anxiety is there in good times and bad times for different reasons. One is holding on to what you got, and the other is keeping up or catching up with the Joneses. What I point out in the book is that in every post-war recession until now, at least, when the economy goes down, layoffs don't actually increase. The total number of job separations does not increase. It's fairly flat. And what increases is the time that people who are unemployed remain unemployed. And it remains to be seen what's you know, if this is the Great Depression 2.0, you can throw all that out the window, and anxieties are, you know, very real and necessary. But it could be a very bad recession in which people at the top, I'm really writing about the top half of the income distribution, remember, are, even though the white-collar layoffs get most media attention because they're the people writing the newspapers and on TV and want to talk about themselves, mm-hmm. the people who are bearing the brunt of it so far, and I imagine going forward, are people at the bottom half of the distribution. And
the layoffs, you mean?
Exactly, mm-hmm. yeah. And it remains to be seen, for example, the recent figures for the new unemployment applications are down, actually. So we might be through the worst of it already. And I think it's going to take a couple years to see what exactly the dynamics were. The American economy is always creating jobs and always destroying jobs. It's what's happening net. And net has been a very bad story in the last year. But a lot of those jobs, there's definitely layoffs, and they're definitely getting more attention. Whether this is a depression and not a recession remains to be seen. I think what's very shocking about it is the decline. It's a financial crisis and a recession at the same time. And when we had the 82-83 recession, which was pretty bad as well, we didn't have a financial crisis at the same time. And so I think that plays into a lot of our anxieties, that our economy really is like a Madoff house of cards, that it's not just him. He's a symbol for what a lot of us worry about, that the whole economy is fraudulent in a way because it's so far removed from the actual provision of material goods, necessities, and physical manufacture that even in good times we feel maybe that we're frauds, some of us, that work in a knowledge industry where there's really nothing tangible we can point to that I made that. And I think that gets accentuated when we really fear for losing our jobs.
Weightless, but the BlackBerry may be on. Let's keep our eye on this lifestyle, how it works across income levels and jobs. Kathy in Nashville, Tennessee. Kathy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to offer a different perspective on the phenomenon of being accessible 24 hours a day being a new one. My husband's grandfather was a dairy farmer, and he got up at 5 in the morning to milk the cows for the first time. He milked them again before he went to bed at night.
Right.
And every moment in between, he was working in the garden or baling hay or, you know, repairing things in the barn. And so, if anything, it's a very difficult lifestyle that is an old profession, you know.
Mm-hmm. You know, you point to one of the toughest ones of all, Kathy. I grew up with a lot of dairy farmers. We had sheep, and this time of the year, you'd be out in the barn at all times of night when the ewes were lambing. I mean, Dalton Connolly, it is certainly the case that for people in lots of modes, dairy farmers above all, working long, long hours is nothing new.
Right. I if you look at the people who work from home, from the 60s until now, actually from 1960 to 1980, it declined. And what that represented was basically the declining fortunes of the family farm, so fewer and fewer farmers. But as of 1980, the amount of people who work from home as their principal place of work has steadily increased. And in a way, we're all like farmers now. Ironically, we're just milking something else,
Without that sweet smell of alfalfa. Kathy, thanks for your call. Let's get a call from San Diego, California, and Jonathan. Jonathan, you're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to just point out about the recent graduates in 2008 and the ones that are coming out in 2009.
Yes.
The types of economic conditions we're going to be going through the job market. And, you know, for example, with me, I got over $100,000 of student loans. And, yes, I've accepted that responsibility that, you know, I got to either A, get a job, or B, start a business. And I chose to do the latter instead. And I want to create more jobs for people around me as well. But with my generation, you know, people who were born in the 80s or late 80s, it's embedded in us that, you know, we're going to be probably working, you know, pretty much close to 24 hours a day. And if we have an exit strategy in mind, we can, you know, try to retire by the age of 50, maybe even earlier than that.
So certainly if you're starting a business, that's a real 24/7 path. Do you have any misgivings about stepping onto it, Jonathan?
No, it's just something that I just got to do because I want to help out people just get jobs. I'm just one of those people who just really care about, like, you know, my fellow students that I've been working with, and I'm trying to get them jobs too.
A philanthropist of sorts.
Young entrepreneurs.
Oh, we hope there's something in it for you too as well. I imagine you expect it. You know, Dalton, here we come to this issue of expectations. Jonathan stepping out, brand new graduate, wants to start a business. I mean, and he says there's a whole generation that just expect to work and work. The photo on your dust jacket on the book is a family at dinner. No one is talking to each other. There's a family of five, three laptops on the table. The daughter, or three, or family of four, and the daughter with her iPod, her earbuds in. I mean, is this just what we're all in training for? Always, yes, we're living, we're eating dinner, but even if we're at the table, you've got the laptop cranked up, the email going, the messaging going, the buds in the ears. We're never fully there as unitary people.
Right. And I think that for people in my generation who grew up half without the internet and half with the internet, that's a, you know, it's we're struggling the most probably. And people born in the 80s, probably this is quite normal. There's no other way to live, and it's fine. And I'm not trying to say there's some glorious past that we should try to get back to. I'm just trying to describe the changes that have occurred.
You really think it's fine? You're so-called intravidual. You really think it's fine that even when people eat together, a very basic human activity, sort of a communal moment from the dawn of time, and now at that table, they're not really there?
I think you should ask Jonathan that, not me. I know where you're pushing me, and I'm not. I refuse to. I take the fifth on
you,
that.
You really don't make a judgment in your book.
I try not to. I do want to comment on something else Jonathan said. I've two things. One is I mentioned that, you know, when times get tough, yes, there may be an increase in layoffs, but what really, really happens is that people who don't have a job have enormous, enormous problems and longer spells of unemployment. And that's not good news for recent college graduates. So if he can actually create some jobs, that's great. And the second thing that his point illustrates that I talk about in the book is the not just the collapse between home and office or work and leisure, but there's been a collapse from a lot of sort of spheres that were once divided in modern capitalism. And that one is between philanthropy and business. And he's using the language of philanthropy, he wants to go into private profit-making venture, but he wants to do it for a reason of creating jobs to help people. We've seen an increase in cause, what's called cause marketing, Gap Red, for example, campaign, which assuages our consumeristic mm-hmm. guilt, that old Protestant ethic curmudgeon inside of ourselves that's peeping up once in a while. In a culture where the sociologist Juliet Shore points out that we now buy 55 garments per year on average, more than one item of clothing a week, at least in good times, we feel guilty about that because we still have that kind of ascetic quality to us, to our culture. And so what's the solution to that? Buy Keeper Springs bottled water where the profits go to donate to help the environment, kind of ironically, I think, since the bottled water industry is one of the big environmental nightmares.
And work round the clock maybe to do it.
Dalton, to pay for it all.
To pay for it. Let me get a call from Nashville. And Mark. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My challenge is that you mentioned before that parents, see, I remember my father coming in at 8, 9, 10 o'clock at night after work, and it was late. I tend to fall into the same problem. I'm coming in late. And my challenge really is, when do I stop work? When do I come home? Is it when the job is done, or is it when the time clock stops? 5:30, 6 o'clock, When do I come home?
Well, why not 9 to 5? I mean, that was our old-fashioned view of work at 5 o'clock. The big bell goes off with a siren and everybody punches out.
And the job is not done yet.
but it'll be there tomorrow, won't it, Mark, or not?
It certainly will.
Can I ask Mark what industry he works in?
Mark?
I work in IT.
See, IT. Why can't you just come home and log into remote desktop or something like that and work from home and finish the job?
That is true, and I do that occasionally. And I tend to, actually, when I get home, family requirements are the bigger priority once I'm actually there.
But it's a great point. Just the question standing there, when is it done in an IT? I suppose, in a way, it's never done.
And one consequence of all this is, at least to survey takers, people report sleeping 1 hour on average less than they did in the 1960s.
Oh boy.
Now, I don't know. I find it biologically hard to believe that the whole, North American human population can get by on 1 hour less sleep, or if that's not itself part of a new ethic, of kind of bragging about how little you sleep and how much you work. One thing for sure we're doing less of is drinking. So those three cocktails after work are gone now for many professionals. But now adults anywhere from 30s to 60s are using more illicit drugs and illicit drugs, prescription tranquilizers and such, than their teenagers are. So it's all these bizarre things are happening, I think.
Oh, boy. Let's go to Dave in Syracuse, New York. Dave, you're on the air. What's your story?
Hi, Tom. This is a great show. Listen, I wanted to say to everybody, you have choices when it comes to your work life. When I started working, I was in the military, and then when I left the service, I went into the IT business and worked until I was 30 years old. As an IT technician and eventually a manager and eventually started running my own company. And I found myself working 70, 80, 90 hours a week. And it started getting to my health and my family. There were times I would literally, at my home office, work so late that I'd fall asleep at my keyboard.
How did you solve it, Dave?
Well, this is exactly how I solved it. I got fed up. I talked to my wife and my family. And I cashed out, got rid of the business, completely closed everything down. Put an addition on my parents' home, moved out of the city into the country a few miles away, and did what I fell in love with when I very first started my work life, which I have always loved to drive. And so what I ended up doing is becoming a truck driver.
on the road again.
Yeah. But, that you're talking about a lot of working hours. Folks don't realize that you can work different hours and still make it and have a life of your own outside of work. I work 4 days a week. I'm home 3 days, and I get three weeks vacation a year. So it worked out really well for me, and when I leave my job, I leave it completely. I don't think about it anymore. I go home, and I spend my time with my family.
Truck driving Dave, we've got the story, and we appreciate it. Dalton Conley, Dave reminds us, he says, you have choices. Is that the problem here?
Well, it is.
People don't take them? We all have choices.
I don't think that's the problem, because not all of us can take such a radical – and it's interesting that it takes such a radical solution. Basically, sell the business, pack up the family, move to the country, and completely change careers. Tougher and more – yet in some ways more realistic approach for most of us would be, how do you keep your career, that you like and enjoy, but yet be there for your kids, for your spouse, for – your friends and so forth.
Why not put a little damper on the economic ambition to buy those extra hours? Or are Americans afraid to do that because of the economic inequality you're talking about?
I think that's the root of the problem. That's why I think we can't just blame it on the Blackberries, and we have to look at the deeper, more invisible social forces.
They're going. Where's the end to this, Dalton Conley?
I don't know. We once lived in big extended families, and then we move to the nuclear family, and then more and more people live alone. And even one of the fastest growing trends in new housing starts is to have separate bedrooms, master bedroom suites for both parents, because I guess they want to stay up at different hours and
so
work.
So their BlackBerry and cell phone doesn't bother their mate.
Right, and they want to watch different things on TV or what have you. And, you know, pretty soon we're going to need multiple bedrooms for ourselves because we, you know, each of us, the selves inside of us are going to want to like a different kind of mattress.
What'll it be tonight, my working bedroom or my sleeping bedroom?
Right.
Oh, boy. What a picture. Dalton Connolly, it's absolutely fascinating. Clearly, I don't know where we are on the curve of this one, but life just keeps changing, and you bring us up to date with a lot of it. Thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Thank you, Tom.
Dalton Connolly's new book is Elsewhere USA, How We Got From the Company Man, Family Dinners, and the Affluent Society to the Home Office, BlackBerry Moms, and Economic Anxiety. Of course, President Barack Obama moving into the White House next week with his BlackBerry. They say they'll take it away. He's bringing his mother-in-law with him. Maybe she'll make life simpler for the family. Thanks for joining us this hour. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.